It's just wonderful to be able to build homes for people to live in that transforms their life. You know, the home is the most important thing you have in your life to flourish. If you don't have a home, then there's, you know, so many challenges you face.
Welcome to the Passive House Podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your questions answered, and contribute to the community dialogue. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our weekly Passive House Accelerator live webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. G'day and welcome back to the Passive House podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And I'm Zach Semke, coming to you from Seattle, Washington.
How you going, Zach?
I'm well. How are you, Matthew?
Pretty good. Autumn here. We had a massive rain dump. I've installed a weather station on our roof a few weeks ago, and when I left, it was over 10 mils since midnight. So we had 10 millimeters of rain in a fairly short period of time, which and now it's blue sky, so it's kind of crazy.
Well, it is totally gorgeous right now. Really beautiful.
Yeah. Which is in keeping. I actually was at a building event, industry seminar yesterday, and it was all about building for climate change or building with climate change. It was definitely more on the resilience and adaptation side of things rather than on, you know, how do we reduce carbon, which I was a little bit disappointed about. I was waiting for the bit to talk about, you know, how we're going to actually make things better, but it was more talking about flooding, landslides, inundation, high wind, and high humidity. Interestingly, the prediction for where I am is getting warmer, longer periods of excessive heat, and around about the same total rainfall, but it coming in more intense bursts. Which I thought was interesting. That's the sort of prediction. Who knows what reality will be like? But regardless, that'll bump up the humidity when you get that combination of increasing temperature and lots of rain. So that's going to be a problem because we don't handle humidity with our building the way we do it here very well, particularly when that humidity is when there's a lot of it inside the building, which there does tend to be a lot of here. So, yeah, it's challenging times ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think about the impacts not only on human health, but also on the health of our buildings.
Yeah, and it just never ceases to amaze and also slightly frustrate me when, you know, we have the solutions for dealing with this, but there's just so much resistance to things like air tightness, or even in our case, continuous ventilation. That's just a huge challenge for us right now, is to convince people that windows don't work consistently enough by themselves, and that you actually need a fan to bring air into a house. So, yeah, that's taking up a lot of my time and energy at the moment, and probably for some time to come. Yep. Anyway, we're gonna be jumping over to the other side of the world and talk about how things have been going in Scotland recently. We've got an interview which I did earlier this year, 2024, but it actually was sparked off by some news and headlines that I saw, I think, towards the end of 2023. So there's some great stuff there that we want to check in with. But before we do that, let's say thanks to our supporters.
Absolutely. So a big thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority. Thanks to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Glavel, Ingwe Architecture, Minotaur, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. And thank you to our champion sponsors, Bewizo, Gradient, Icon Windows and Doors, Intelligent Membranes, PH AirSeal, Prosico, and Source 2050.
Awesome. All right. Well, I saw a headline, I think late in 2023, about some passive houses being built in Scotland. And there was a combination there of affordable housing, social type housing, and passive house. And I thought, well, that sounds really good, because I'd also heard that there were moves in Scotland to move the whole building code more in the direction effectively of passive house. So I reached out to Hanover, Scotland, and I eventually got to record a conversation with their chief executive, Angela Curry. And well, I think we'll just jump straight into it. And there is another episode or another podcast that we'll put a link to for a bit of background that people can also listen to, that Angela and a colleague of hers also took part in, with the addition of some comments from some of the tenants of the houses that they completed there. So we'll put that in the show notes, but let's jump in, and we'll have a bit of a debrief afterwards. This is Angela Curry, Chief Executive of Hanover, Scotland. Thank you very much, Angela, for joining me. Where are you situated at the moment?
I'm just outside of Edinburgh in Scotland.
And is that where you're based? Is Hanover sort of located in Edinburgh?
Yeah, our main office is in Edinburgh, but we have an office in Glasgow in the west of the country, and also on the northeast coast in a town called Elgin.
And for people who haven't had the pleasure of visiting your part of the world, what's it like? How would you describe it in terms of weather and the type of the environment?
Yeah, well, Scotland's a country of four seasons, and you usually get them all in one day. Quite a cool climate, I suppose, in comparison to other countries. So our housing and our housing design is really important because of that cooler climate, quite a wet climate, particularly on the west coast.
So you're in the middle of winter, or just coming out of winter?
Yeah,
as we're recording.
Yeah, we're just coming out of winter, looking forward to spring. And we've had quite an unusual winter in the UK. We've had many storms, much more than we normally would have. So we're really seeing the effects of climate change. So much wetter and windier than we've ever seen before. And of course, that could be a one-off, but we are, you know, slightly concerned that this is the climate of the future.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about your background, because I want to get into talking about what you're doing now, but how have you got into doing what you're doing?
I think I like a lot of people who get into the social housing sector, almost come across it by default. So I got into it because I worked for a local authority and discovered the wonderful world of social housing in particular, and have had a 30-year career in social housing. I've worked for local authorities across Scotland in various roles. I worked in the front line to begin with as a housing officer for 18 months. And then started to progress in the organisations I worked in, mainly in policy, research, performance management, community engagement roles. And I've worked in the main benchmarking organisation in Scotland, where social housing providers come together to share practice, to compare performance and learn from each other. Did that for a long time, really enjoyed that, getting to know the whole sector, getting to know the individuals and see all the great work they do, And more recently, for the last 8 or 9 years, I've worked in what's called the registered social landlord sector. So these are housing associations that are charities, not-for-profit organisations that operate in Scotland. We have around 130 housing associations in Scotland and 32 local authorities. They all provide social housing, affordable social housing for rent, along with other products, but are very much community based and focused organisations who provide that really central service in communities in terms of providing housing and support services.
What's the demand? So what give us a kind of an overview of the state of the housing sector and the need for social housing in Scotland?
Well, the face of social housing in Scotland has changed dramatically in the last 30 years. Prior to a specific piece of legislation being introduced in the early 80s, which was called the Right to Buy, roughly 70% of all housing in Scotland was affordable social housing. And only a small percentage was private rented, and something like 28% was owner occupied.
Up until 1980.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, is that a contrast to south of your border of
no,
the rest of the UK?
No, it was very similar because the right to buy hadn't impacted them at the same time. So the whole of the UK was subject to this right to buy legislation that the Conservative government of the time introduced. Margaret Thatcher, remember that politician, introduced it to give tenants the opportunity to be homeowners. And, some would argue that it was much more about tying people into mortgages not allowing workers to go on strike, for example, very readily if they had mortgages. So if you were cynical, you would see the right to buy as being a destructive tool. But it completely changed the shape of the housing sector in the UK, never mind social housing. So 30 odd years ago, 7 in 10 people were renters in the affordable housing marketplace. 30 years on, it's completely flipped.
Was that 30%, the 70% of renters, were they renting to private owners at that time?
No, they were ownership? State ownership, all local authority owned. Housing associations in the UK had been set up at that point as a vehicle, as a model, a legal model to build housing, but there were very few of them. They were in their infancy. Housing associations have been around for 50 years, but in that first 20 years, when local authorities, the state housing was the main source of housing, housing associations weren't a big part of the marketplace.
Right. And then that's a huge dramatic change in quite a short period of time. That must have shaken up the industry. And I imagine there must have been a lot of speculation and investment.
It's had a massive impact. So in terms of the percentage in Scotland of people who are in social housing, it's 22% now. So it's gone from 70% to 22% in that period of time. And the way that's happened is, lots of people bought their local authority, state-owned social house for a massive discount. Even if the local authority who would take out loans to build those properties, as all, state and registered social landlords do, they take out large private loans and get subsidy from government, central government, to build these houses. So during the right to buy period, the state-owned, the local authority had to sell the property at a massive discount, regardless of the debt they still held on that property. So it allowed many, many people in the UK to access home ownership, which in a lot of ways is fantastic. But a lot of these people, a lot of people living in social housing could afford the mortgage, but over the years, they've not been able to afford the investment in their properties. So to continue to keep them up to date, you know, new kitchens, bathrooms, windows, doors, roofs, all of that. So there's a huge issue in the standard of our homes now in Scotland for those that were bought through the right to buy but weren't continued to be invested in. Whereas the homes that weren't sold, you know, the local authorities have continued with their investment programmes. So those homes are modern, up-to-date, fit for purpose. Even if the style and this, you know, of them is, you know, they might be quite old now, but they have to meet the legal standard that we have in Scotland, around the quality and the standard of the home. So we've got quite a changed sector.
Very changed. And what about the perception of being in a social house? Because I imagine when 70% of people were renting, it was the norm. Is there a different perception now of social housing and those who live in that type of housing?
Yeah, Matthew, it's changed dramatically, and it's now seen as the tenure of least, you know, best choice, because it's been very much portrayed in the press as the place where the poor go and who behave very badly, and you know, the estates are, you know, places that you wouldn't want to go and spend any time. So the image of it has been very much been from that tenure of choice that everyone lived in and grew up in, and to the one of, you know, a place where no one would want to live. Although that has in the last few years started to change. And even just last night on our national news, there was a whole piece of reporting on the dire housing crisis we have in Scotland, because there are so many people looking to rent a home, an affordable home, because of the cost of living crisis, that now social housing is being recognised again as this amazing social tool where people can come and live in affordable homes that are high standard, good quality, great communities, and why have we not got enough of it? It's like we've reawoken to the benefits of that model.
And what's the answer to that question of why you don't have enough of it?
It's a pretty complicated one. We've just had a massive budget cut in the announcement of the Scottish Government's budget at the back end of last year, to say we've had a 25% cut in the subsidy levels that are available for new social housing. So that's huge. That's a big blow. But we have also real challenges with practical elements of increasing the number of social housing homes. We, for example, land prices are through the roof in this country. And it's very hard to, even if when there is subsidy available from government, to find the land in the right place at the right price that allows social housing providers to put a rent, you know, get the rent to comply with what we assume is an affordable level, because the cost of the land and the cost to build at the moment, which is roughly 25-30% higher than normal, is very prohibitive.
That must make going anywhere above the required minimum standard even more challenging. And I'm talking about passive house on a new project.
It's eye-wateringly expensive at the moment to do any house building. And we've even had a number of private house builder firms in the country recently just go into administration because they have got into financial difficulty because of the challenges post-Brexit in terms of material costs and labour costs. So some real challenges in the whole housing sector.
You have got some good success to draw on, though, with some award-winning, an award-winning project, which I think was the first thing that came across my radar of the development in Drymen.
Yeah, it's pronounced Drymen.
Drymen.
And yeah, thank you. it's a lovely village in rural Stirlingshire in the heart of Scotland.
And tell us the story about what went on there, because you had some old houses that were yours.
Yeah, we had it's a tiny picturesque village in the middle of the mountains. And the houses that were built there originally by Hanover were seen as temporary homes 60 years ago. Post-war, built with a standard of housing called Dorian style. So assumed they would only last 60 years. And that's exactly how long they did last. But of course, they were bungalows, so all ground floor properties, and were much loved by the elderly people who lived there. And Hanover Housing Association, who I work for, we are an older person specialist. So we don't have 100% housing for older people. It's about 90. We have some housing for other age groups, but it's generally for older people. And many of the tenants in those homes in Drymen had been in those homes for quite some time and came from this very small village where there was virtually no other social housing left because of the right to buy. The local authority had sold most of its properties in that village. As you can imagine, they were very popular.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lovely story, which we'll put a link to, where people can hear some interviews and some voices of those tenants who have experienced those homes, from Scottish Housing News. And you also talk about how you very carefully dealt with that concern that the people clearly had of, you know, home that they'd spent a lot of their life in. And even I imagine that you're trying to convince them that they're going to get something better, there would be a lot of anxiety around moving out for a period of time. And I think that's addressed really, really nicely there. What I'd like to focus on is why Passive House? When did you first come across Passive House as an organisation, and what made that viable for that project?
Well, I didn't work for the organisation when the board approved the adoption of the Passive House standard for the new build. But in Scotland, the Passive House standard, we've been very much aware of it for many years now, and quite a lot of housing providers have adopted it in organisations to try out the standard. And a big reason for that is our climate and the issue of fuel poverty in Scotland. Given, you know, we generally have three seasons of very cold, wet, windy weather, and, you know, one season that pretends to be slightly warmer called summer. So it's such a big issue for our tenants. But we also have two standards in social housing in Scotland that have to be met. And the first one is the Scottish Housing Quality Standard, which is much more about space and the amenities that are available in a home. And then more recently, we've had an energy efficiency standard that we refer to as EESH. And that has really shone a light on the energy efficiency requirements in social housing, but also much more from a how does the country meet net zero standards and targets. So we've been aware of it for a long time. And when we were looking at the challenges that our tenants had in Drymen, in their existing homes, it primarily related to heating their home. They loved their homes. They didn't want to leave them. They were absolutely not pleasant homes to live in, though, because of the construction style causing lots of condensation and dampness, but also just the heating system was an old style of electric heating because there is no gas supply in the village. So there were so many challenges with it, including the fact that we could have refurbished the properties, but the space standards in the properties didn't meet the new quality standards or building regulations. So we could never have allowed them to meet that standard. So demolition and rebuild was the only viable option. But when you're in a small village that's at quite a high elevation like that, then we knew we'd have to do something special to keep our tenants as warm and as protected from fuel poverty as possible. And the passive house standard seemed like the obvious way to go.
What's Hanover's role in utility bills? Do you help tenants with those, or do you just provide the house?
It depends on the style of house or development that we build. In this development, because they are individual homes, they're not flats, then we don't have a role at all other than to put in an effective heating system, and then it's up to the tenant to arrange to pay their own utility bills.
Right. But as part of your overarching goal, which is essentially looking after people, that you can justify what I'm assuming is a slightly more expensive build cost for you because it's going to look after your people better.
Absolutely. It's an easy argument to make in terms of slightly higher build costs requiring slightly higher subsidy levels from the government to keep the rents affordable, because fuel poverty obviously is linked to your overall household budget. And if your rents are taking up a massive amount of that, you are going to really struggle to pay your utility bills. So keeping the rents affordable, as well as having an energy efficient, warm home with an easy to use heating system, is a big part of that.
And has that been an easy argument to make?
It has been with our board and with Scottish Government for this development, but it's the only passive house development we've built.
Yeah. So where to from here?
Well, the jury is out, because the build in Drimmen is such an unusual one for us, because it's bungalows with some double-storey housing, but very little. We normally don't build properties like that. We normally build sheltered housing developments where you have 30 roughly properties, flats, all in one building with a communal area, a communal heating system, and a kitchen, for example, because we provide meals as part of our sheltered housing service. And so the passive house development in Stirling doesn't allow us to judge whether that approach would work in that very different building style that we would normally build. So we've no new developments planned at the stage where we have to decide which heating system or standard we would use. So we're using this period of time while we have a slight hiatus in our new build programme to evaluate whether we would use a passive house design for what comes next.
Sounds like a good challenge for the passive house design community. But how's the process been in general from, through the passive house process? I mean, through the build certification and then sort of optimizing the performance of the build afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fairly straightforward build, and we had our accreditation without any trouble. So all of that seemed to work well. The architects that we used were very well informed. And so the whole process went really smoothly. In terms of how our tenants are finding living in a passive house as older people generally, it's a really mixed bag, I have to say. If you were going on the tenant experience alone, we wouldn't do it again for that age group.
Mm-hmm.
because the feedback from probably the majority of our tenants is they find the heating system and the whole concept of living in a passive house so different from what they have been used to their whole life that they struggle to manage it effectively.
Yeah, yeah, and I thought I appreciated the that honest feedback when I was listening back to the conversation that you did previously, and I think there's some really good learning there around just how different that might be for someone who's lived in a completely different internal environment. So yeah, I think there's some really important learning there for how to make that transition smoother and to make the benefits more, I guess, acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's a dead interesting observation of, you know, older people are generally at home most of the day. And I suppose a lot of people are now post-COVID. The way we use our home has changed. So the way we need heat is changed in terms of it's not just in the morning and then when you come back from work in the evening, for example. So I think the lifestyle of who's living in a passive house is important in terms of how they are then educated on how to use that system. And I can hear, I've visited the development and spoken to the tenants a few times now. And the general story is the training they received from the various people involved in this process and journey they have been on has been so so inconsistent,
right,
that they are confused. And right, that is, I think, an issue we have in the country about who actually has the knowledge and the skills of how to operate a passive house and a heat pump heating system that can give you simple advice on how to operate your home effectively. So some tenants were terrified to even touch a single dial because one of the people on the site at the end of the build told them not to touch a single button because it would muck it all up. So yeah, they went for months not realizing they could actually tailor when it all kicked in for them, you know, their heating system. So it took months for us to figure out that they'd, you know, a lot of people had been scared off from, you know, tailoring the heating system and timings, etc., to suit their lifestyle. So we've had to go back a few times now and unpick a lot of that and give people new advice and keep going back to check it as working for their lifestyle and the times that they need more or less heat, and, you know, even what temperature they want the property to be at during the evening, because a lot of the tenants had their windows open all night long because it was far too hot in the property and they were really uncomfortable. So we've tried to work with them to get all of that right for them as individual households.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned at the beginning you've had some interesting weather, which is storms. But are you also, is it getting warmer? Do you feel like the summer's been warmer and perhaps a little bit milder during winter?
Yeah, we've definitely not had as much, as long a cold snap as we would normally do in winter months. So it's definitely got milder, wetter. We have had cold weather. We have had a bit of snow in Scotland, but it has not lasted any length of time because on the back of it, we get a mild but wet and windy storm coming in, which has been an absolute feature of this winter.
Right, right. And I think further south in the UK, they had some pretty severe heat waves during the last summer, which I imagine is only going to make the design of homes more challenging as well.
Yeah, definitely. And we had a bit of that in Scotland as well, not as severe, but we definitely had some challenges. And when you speak to some of our tenants, they were finding the passive house just too hot for them. So had windows open in the summer found it quite difficult in the at night time trying to sleep in such a warm home.
Yeah. You also mentioned earlier on that it was a wonderful world of social housing, which I think you were genuine when you talk about that, because you wouldn't have been working in it for so long. Why is it such a wonderful space to work in?
It's just wonderful to be able to build homes for people to live in that transforms their life. You know, the home is the most important thing you have in your life to flourish. If you don't have a home, then there's, you know, so many challenges you face. So being in a sector where you can provide new homes, but also support people to live very well in their existing home, then it's just the most rewarding sector to work in. And because I worked in so many different roles at so many different levels, you get to see that in its all of its manifestations, you know, whether it's helping people who are experiencing homelessness, whether it's helping people who are in a house that's too small and they now have a growing family and they want to move to a bigger house, or whether it's like in the role I'm in just now, working with older people to make their later years fun, engaging, and keeping them as independent and at home for as long as possible is just the best job to be doing. So it's brilliant, and it's a sector that is actually a little bit unknown in the world, I think. You know, people, when they ask me what I do, they probably have never heard of a housing association or the social housing movement. So we are in the country trying to improve the awareness of it as a profession and get more people in, because it's a very rewarding career.
Yeah, great. Well, keep up the good work. You and the team there. Thank you very much, Angela. I really appreciate your time. And, all the best for doing more of what you do.
Thank you. It's lovely to meet you.
And that was Angela Curry. She's the Chief Executive of Hanover Scotland, talking about their experience with Passive House and tenants' experience with Passive House. Now, when I had this chat, I was a little bit nervous about sharing it with you, Zach, because I wasn't sure about...
Didn't you know we're the accelerator?
Yeah. But no, then, in reflection, I thought, this is really important stuff. This is really good to know about the experience that some people have doing something different.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. It was really, really interesting. And I know we'll dive into the tenant experience. Before we do, I just was just to say that I was really interested to hear about that, the kind of history of the right to buy and the way that that flipped the whole affordable housing kind of situation on its head, moving from something like 70% of folks in social housing now down to 30%, and how that's really exacerbated the situation right now in terms of affordability in housing. And so, you know, the work of folks like Hanover is clearly just so important.
Yeah.
In Scotland.
Yeah. I just can't imagine anything like that happening these days, where that just complete paradigm shift in home ownership and what that does to the whole of society.
It really shook everything up.
So I guess the thing that stuck out for me was about communication and expectation management and the things that we have to be aware of when you're doing something that's so different from what has been done in the past. And I think that extends to all the people involved in the project, the people who are delivering the project, the people who are going to be owning the buildings or running the buildings, but critically, the people who are going to be living in the buildings. And it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I think a lot of our audience will be pretty familiar with having to talk to people about things like airtightness and continuous ventilation and the fact that you don't need to have a fireplace and those sorts of things, but probably more from a client point of view. I can't imagine, except that I imagine it would be very hard, but I haven't been in that situation where I'm giving someone a house, expecting them to be just blown away by how great it is.
Yeah.
But then for them to be, I guess, a little bit less than pleased by their experience.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was surprised, definitely, when I was listening to the interview, and so went to the other podcast that you mentioned to listen to the stories myself, just to understand. What really stood out. So in that podcast, and we'll include a link to the interview, they interview one tenant and then refer to feedback from other tenants. And the one tenant they interview actually is quite pleased with the experience, saying that it's comfortable and that if it ever gets stuffy, they can boost the ventilation, which they really like. Like, they like having a ventilation system and all that stuff. But what really stood out was that they were told to not touch the dials on the boiler. Like, just don't touch anything.
Yeah.
So when we hear about this story, it makes you wonder about that overheating experience. Like, was that where if all the tenants were being told not to manipulate their heating and cooling system, that's problematic. And I think a really good lesson to take away for all of us when we're like that moment where we're kind of handing over the keys to the tenants and training them. Like, I have to say that, like, when I think about passive house and passive house systems, it's not, it doesn't feel complicated. These are not, they're not complicated homes to be inside or buildings to be inside. A lot of it is set it and forget it kind of. But I think that one place where that's not, that where it is definitely new is the technology around heating. And that's actually not necessarily specific to passive house. It's really about when we're transitioning to heat pumps.
Yeah.
Just like learning how to use the remote control on a mini split system takes some time.
Yeah. It's different.
Yeah, it's different. And so, to then expose people who are, have decades of experience operating a totally different system to kind of
throw that at them. You don't want them to be scared of breaking something. And I think if you say don't touch anything, that instills fear that, oh my gosh, if I do touch something, then it might go horribly wrong. I mean, that reminds me of my trying to show my parents how to use a computer because they're so scared of losing something on the screen, or it's like, don't worry, you'll be able to get it back. Just try something,
Right.
So I think there's a bit of an element of that. If you give that instruction of it's set up, you don't need to do anything, don't touch anything, that doesn't induce any sort of, wanting people to interact. And I guess there's a couple of different design philosophies as well as you design something so well that it is completely set and forget and doesn't require any input other than maybe a bit of maintenance or a change of mode during the switchover from summer to winter, or you bring people along on the journey and try and educate them enough that they understand what the filters are and what the buttons do to temperature up and down and ventilation up and down, so that they do feel in control. And I guess in this case, they've got the additional challenge of a generational challenge, I guess, of mm-hmm. Deciding how much they can teach tenants, or how interested those particular tenants will be interested in learning all the details. So yeah. I don't know. It's definitely a tough one, but I think that hopefully this is people do find this valuable and think about what's appropriate in terms of communication and education and inducting people into their passive house particularly if it's the first time that they're moving into one.
Right. Because definitely it was a real issue. Like so there was that one interview with one occupant on the other podcast, but also, a report from the folks at Hanover that there were definitely others who were less positive about their yeah. experience.
Yeah.
And so that's I think it's a really important kind of reminder for all of us. And I think another thing is that it's possible that overheating issue that was discussed was because people didn't feel like they could touch the dials. It's also possible that there was some, that there was some overheating problems.
Totally.
And one of the, things that we talk a lot about in the passive house world right now is, that we need to be looking at the changing climate and look at climate files or use climate files in our designs that reflect the fact that things are getting warmer. And also maybe be a little bit more ambitious or aggressive about ensuring that we've got good cooling strategies dialed in.
So in our part of the world, there's a lot of people here would agree that the 10% threshold for passive house standard, international passive house, would be too high. I mean, 10% is the allowable time for passive house that you can be over 25 degrees, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's actually quite a lot. And we think there's a lot of people here that say that's too much, particularly when you also throw into that mix that's 25 degrees with the current climate file.
Yeah.
So if you plug in some adjusted climate files and say, well, how many, what's that going to look like in 10, 20, 30 years? We're designing buildings that will hopefully be around for a lot longer than that. Then that number could climb up. So in my other day-to-day work, we actually set targets far lower than that, sort of 7, 5, and then even 3, only 3% overheating exceedance. And I think, people definitely need a cooling strategy, and that might be various things, whether it's a part of ventilation, a ceiling fan can definitely add to comfort levels. And in a lot of cases, it's going to be a split system heat pump that also works as a reverse cycle air conditioner.
Yeah, and you've mentioned before, I think, this around cooling. What was I going to say?
Well, I forgot to mention external shading. That's the key. One of the key ones is really looking at shading and stopping that heat getting in during the summer and also the shoulder seasons as well. A lot of people get caught out by the shoulder seasons.
Yeah, and I the other thing that also has changed, of course, is that we're in our buildings, we're in our homes a lot more than we used to be after COVID. And of course, seniors that's been something that, for retired people, they're in their homes more anyway. And so that 10% overheating is experienced much more acutely.
Yes.
Than it was before.
That's right.
And so it's not only are things getting hotter, and so we there's a possibility of kind of undershooting the target on cooling just because of that, but also people are at home more. It's really something to be taken seriously. So I think it's incumbent upon our community and the certifications, and I know FIAS has been really focused on ensuring that there's adequate cooling on passive buildings. It's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that is really delivered, because we, we don't want to have people uncomfortable. That's like the antithesis of our whole project.
Yeah. One other note around cost, and I don't think Hanover were guilty of this, but it is a risk that people take costings from the first project that they do, which is a tough one because the first time you do anything, it's going to be more expensive, it's going to take longer, there's going to be more issues. And that's a real challenge, particularly when you're dealing with people who don't like change, or you know, whether it's be the builder that you're working with, that just the council that you have to get permission from, or you know, the whole building industry, very quick to sort of point out something that's more expensive, has taken longer to build, whatever the case may be, and that's always going to be the case. We have to treat the first project of any organization almost like a prototype, and realize that there are going to be a lot of efficiencies gained fairly quickly following that first project.
So
that's where the people like the accelerator can step in and provide lots and lots of case studies of where costs have come down to near equivalent of standard builds, and reaching out, networking with people who've got over that hump and starting to do things quicker, cheaper, with far greater outcomes. So that's a big challenge as well, stepping over that sort of first the first project hump. Also, just to finish off on a positive note, two positive notes really. Hats off to Hanover for giving it a go. You know, it's fantastic to have organisations like this that try new things, and hopefully they can learn from this and see the benefits. I'm sure that the tenants will benefit from being in a much more comfortable, healthy environment. And also Scotland in general, I think we should do a bit of an update at some stage of how things are going there, because they did announce early last year, January 2023, there are new standards of the building code, which are pretty much equivalent to Passive House. So, you know, Scotland in general is doing some really cool stuff, and supported, of course, by the Passive House Trust in that part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting. Yeah, we need to get Sarah Lewis from Passive House Trust on so that she can tell us the latest.
Very good. All right. Keen for people's feedback, thoughts on that. If you'd like to share anything, please get in touch. You can always contact us at Passive House Accelerator. What have we got coming up, Zach?
Well, this week for the 101 series of Passive House Accelerator Live on Wednesday, May 1st, we're joined by Enrico Bonolari of EMU Systems, or EMU Passive, rather. And he's going to be talking about unusual suspects of building science, details that matter. So Enrico's great, and I'm really looking forward to this episode of the 101 series. And then on May 17th, we're doing a special Reimagine Buildings Live prefab conference. It'll be a 3 to 4 hour long, well, 3 hours of programming, and then also a trade show conference that will be similar in kind of vibe and production value and networking capacity to our Reimagine Buildings 24, but it will be very focused both in the duration of time. It's not 24 hours, it's 3 to 4 hours, and also really focused on prefab. Really, we're super excited about that one. So mark your calendars for May 17th.
And that'll be just a few days before the Thrive Passive House Conference in Australia, hosted by the Australian Passive House Association. So good to see that gaining momentum, and I think it's going to be a great event.
Yeah, that's awesome. That'll be fun.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for that, Zach. I hope everyone's enjoying.
Thank you.
And I think we've still got some bonus episodes coming out from Innsbruck.
We do. I think we have a couple more. We've got some great interviews, so definitely check those out.
Great. All right, those will be in your feed.
Mary and Ilka were busy. Jose got one, and Michael did a couple. So
excellent,
really good stuff. Yeah,
thank you very much. We'll be back again next week on Passive House Podcast.